Hello.
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 Fire.
Hello. For those that
Hello.
are joining, hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
Hi.
yes.
This is Rachel Fowler from the U.S. Human Rights Network, and we'll be starting the quarterly call here shortly. I think folks will be calling in over the next couple of minutes. If you are signed up as a presenter, your line is unmuted at this time.
Hello, Dustin here.
Hello?
Athea here.
Hey, Athea. Yes.
Oh, this is Malefa here.
Stephanie. Hi, Athea.
Hi.
Hey.
Hi, you guys, the folks that are presenters, if you could mute with star six. Because we have you guys open for the call, and we're going to let folks call in, and then we'll start here shortly.
Okay, thank you, Rachel.
Thank you.
Morning.
Good morning. Hi, everyone. We'll be starting the quarterly member call shortly. If you're signed up as a presenter, if you could please star six to mute your phone.
Star six.
Hi, everyone. This is Rachel Fowler with the U.S. Human Rights Network. For the folks that are calling in for the call, we're going to wait a few more minutes and give folks a chance to phone in, and then we will start shortly. Hi, I see folks calling in. This is Rachel with the U.S. Human Rights Network. We thank everybody that's calling in today for the call. We're going to wait just a few more minutes and give more folks time to phone in, and we'll be starting shortly.
Hello?
Thank you for joining the call. We'll get started in a couple of minutes, just giving people some more time to call in.
Cool, thanks.
Okay. Hi, everyone. This is Rachel Fowler with the U.S. Human Rights Network. It's 12:05, so we're going to go ahead and get the call started. And thank you for joining. This is our third quarterly member call. We had our first in March and our second in June. These were quarterly member calls were suggested to us at the biennial conference during our member meeting at the conference, and as a way for members to hear work that is ongoing around the country, work that our members are engaged in, including also work that is organized from the Coordinating Center itself, including education opportunities that are coming up, member opportunities that are coming up, et cetera. So today we're excited to have a number of members present on the work that they've been engaged in related to the international mechanisms, as well as to some recent gatherings, human rights gatherings that have been held in the country. And then we've also really tried to support members being able to present on the work that they're doing and, you know, highlight campaigns or events that are coming up, work that they are involved in their with their organization in their local area. And we had a number of members reach back out and say that they wanted to share the work that they're doing. So we're really excited about that. The folks that have signed up to present, you all are on the phone as presenters. So if you can use star 6 to mute and unmute when I call on you. The first part of the agenda is for members to share, like I said, on the work they've done related to the mechanisms, as well as recent gatherings. We'll start with that, take some questions and answers after that from folks, if we have any, and then we'll move to the member report backs, and then from there we'll move to just a quick update on some upcoming events and educational opportunities. So with that, again, my name is Rachel Fowler. I'm here in the Atlanta Coordinating Center office, and we welcome the folks to the call. We are using AccuConference, so hopefully we won't have too many technical difficulties, but if we run into those, we'll work through them. And if folks can please star 6 their phones, if they could mute their phones, because we are getting some background noise. So with that, Stephanie Franklin, who's been involved with our CERD work, will start by giving us a presentation or providing us with information about the recent CERD work she's done related to the foster care system. So, Stephanie?
Okay, Rachel, good afternoon. Thank you very much for allowing me to present today, and I want to start off by thanking the network just for being very supportive and really pushing me to bring this issue on an international stage. I want to thank the network and all of those who traveled to Geneva and who also did not travel to Geneva who supported my work. So my issue that I took before the CERD committee was the over-medication of psychotropic drugs on African-American girls in foster care. And so the reason why I selected that issue was for several reasons. First, just a brief overview of the organization that I own is the Franklin Law Group. We're a small law firm located in Baltimore, Maryland, and we represent children who have been abused and neglected in local courts in 5 counties in the state of Maryland. And we've been doing this since 2007, and we have represented over 4,000 children in foster care. The reason why I took this particular issue to the CERD committee is that I had really observed that there was little to no advocacy internationally around foster care issues, particularly as it pertained to children of African descent and more specifically girls of African descent. What I have observed in the number of years that I've been doing this work, so it's been over 15 years, is that there has been a significant increase in the psychotropic drug use in foster care children generally. And knowing that black children are the highest disproportionate group in foster care, I thought that it would be very important that quantitative as well as qualitative data on the use of psychotropics on black children really be raised on that level. So I focused on girls specifically because the impact that a number of human rights issues have on black girls and women are rarely raised, and the issues are often marginalized, even within the broader social justice and human rights advocacy work. So later I learned through my writing that my feeling and my sentiment and what I observed was dead on point in the sense that I recognized that the CERB committee was specifically interested in the gender dimensions within race and ethnicity, as they indicated that the state parties and nor civil society actually presents many reports on issues pertaining to women of color. So having said that, and they issued a comment, a general comment on that issue. So with all this in mind, I did travel to Geneva thanks to the network, and I really did get some great results, particularly on an issue that's never been raised on an international level, and specifically an issue that very little people knew anything about, if at all. So what the CERB committee did in its concluding observations, specifically under Section D, other recommendations and requests for further information, they indicated that in the next periodic report by the U.S., that they wanted detailed information on the rate that African-American children in foster care are prescribed psychotropic medication. So with those concluding observations, I have laid out a plan on how I will utilize and have begun utilizing the concluding observations to further my work on this particular issue. So it's really multidimensional. It's three parts. So first is to, and I had begun working on it, but now there's more of a push to launch a national campaign on African-American girls in foster care and psychotropic drugging. I will do that through community awareness events about issues, about human rights issues, about this specific issue, and about the CERB concluding observations, with that, which I have already begun. Speaking at multidisciplinary national, state, and local conferences on the issue in a human rights framework, and utilizing the CERB concluding observations to do so. And when I say multidisciplinary, I think sometimes some of the social justice policy groups really get it, but some of the more conservative groups like judicial groups or legal groups that are more traditionally focused possibly on litigation and other areas don't really fully understand this issue. So I am submitting to conferences that are judicial conferences and legal conferences to address this human rights issue. I also looking to collect nationwide stories on the use and impact of psychotropic drugs on African-American girls in foster care, video these stories, and collect this data to push policies and laws. And also I would like to create a tribunal to address these issues. As it relates to policy and legislation, I'm looking at federal, state, and local laws. I want to utilize the findings as a foundation to modify existing laws and policies and implement new ones to ensure the human rights protections for African-American girls and boys in foster care and foster care children generally. I want to utilize the findings to push scrutiny on how these laws are impacting African-American children, focusing on a gender lens, and continuing to push the other recommendations that I requested in my report that were just not about data. I want to utilize the findings to advocate for the ratification of other treaties like the CRC, CEDAR, ICESCR, and CRPD, and also look to invite a special rapporteur on children and or people of African descent. And lastly, my strategy is to utilize it in our litigation. The fortunate piece about what we do is that we've been collecting information on the use of psychotropic drugs on foster care children because we represent a number of children in this state. So we do have quantitative data and qualitative data based on the children that we represent. But I think it's very important that as a staff, the staff attorneys will be trained in my office to utilize a human rights framework to advocate for children in foster care that's not limited to CERD, but human rights generally. And we're hoping that the use of this language, along with the Maryland statutes and other state statutes and other places may push judges and magistrates to use the human rights language in their decision. And using these concluding observations issued by CERD to push advocacy for African-American children, specifically girls, and other foster care children generally on the high use of psychotropic meds, and to continue collecting the quantitative and qualitative data in-house to underscore the findings and the particular issue. So that's how we are currently utilizing the work and plan to utilize the work. I've already met with a staffer, with one of the congresspeople in D.C. on the Hill, to try to structure a Hill briefing on this particular issue. So that concludes my presentation. And there are other things, Rachel, I wanted to ask that I wanted to talk about pertaining to the International Decade of People of African Descent, but I'm assuming that I can make those announcements on about that particular initiative and particular events later in the agenda. Is that correct?
Yes, Stephanie, that's correct. And thank you for the presentation. That was very informative. And now Jocelyn Formsma with the National Indian Child Welfare Association is going to share on the work that they've engaged with utilizing CERD to protect Indigenous children in the U.S. Jocelyn, if you can unmute with star 6.
Hi, I'm here. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, great. Hello, everybody. I don't know if I didn't get a chance to meet everyone during our session in Geneva, and I know that there's some folks who are on the call that weren't there, but just briefly, my name is Jocelyn, and I'm a board member of the National Indian Child Welfare Association, and I'm going to use the word or the short form NICWA from now on. And I actually live in Canada, and I've been doing work in child welfare policy for the last maybe 7 or 8 years or so. But I've been a board member of NICWA also for about 7 years. And what we see is a lot of very similar in terms of statistics and the situations for Indigenous children in child welfare on both sides of the border. And actually also very similar statistics in places like Australia, New Zealand, any place where basically colonization has occurred, and very, very similar statistics. So NICWA itself has been around for about 30 years, and essentially the mission is dedicated to the well-being of American Indian, Alaska Native children and families, and all of our work and policy, research, programming, all that is about ensuring that every Indigenous child has access to community-based, culturally appropriate services that help them grow up safe and healthy in their communities and in their families. And so our role, I'm going to skip a big piece of it and just kind of go to, in terms of our history, and then just go to our involvement with a Supreme Court case called Adoptive Couple and Baby Girl. And it was about a 4-year-old Native child going into a contested adoption to be removed from her home, from her father and her tribe, and she was placed into a non-Native home hundreds of miles away, and the Supreme Court refused to consider whether or not this placement, absent a best interest hearing, best interest of the child hearing, was a violation of Veronica, baby Veronica, and her father's constitutional rights. So we were heavily involved in that, but baby Veronica might have been one of the biggest stories that made it into the media in the U.S., but what we know is that Indigenous children are removed by the child welfare system at 4 times the rate of white children, and that over 50% of the children who have been adopted have been adopted into non-Aboriginal or non-Indigenous homes. And so the private adoption child welfare systems are also becoming increasingly problematic for Indigenous children in the U.S. So So we initially wrote a letter to the Special Rapporteur for Indigenous Peoples, and he, at the time it was a he, now they've switched, he responded and intervened on behalf of Nikwa and on behalf of Baby Veronica, and that was sort of our first foray into the international realm. I personally have been doing international work for about 5 years, but I think Nikwa has only really been doing international work for 2 years or so. So getting to our participation at CERD, this is really part and parcel of our domestic advocacy work. Basically, we've exhausted every single domestic avenue possible to us. You know, over 30 years, we've tried everything at every single level, state, you know, municipal, federal, and so we really felt, okay, we're not getting anywhere anymore, but we need to go to the international realm. So we submitted a CERD shadow report, and we were really pushing for federal oversight of the Indian Child Welfare Act, which has a lot of good components in it, but really isn't being complied with at the federal or state level. And it's the only piece of federal legislation that has no type of oversight at all. We also looked at compliance in terms of education and understanding at ICWA, from judges to lawyers to communities, anywhere. And lack of binding regulations that the Indian Child Welfare Act, as well as inadequate funding for tribes to be able to enact their own solutions. So we asked a couple of questions of the U.S., and basically we were saying that we want U.S. to address the problem of the overrepresentation of Indigenous children going into child welfare. And we want oversight, federal oversight, to ensure that states are complying with ICWA. And a lot of times the inherent jurisdiction of the tribes isn't being recognized in custody proceedings, and due to insufficient resources that the tribes have, many of them just aren't able to go after the issue. To ensure that their jurisdiction is being respected. And then finally, what we're finding is that there's Indigenous families that are facing biased treatment in the private child welfare and private adoption systems. And so we basically asked the U.S. to ask why that is. And the CERD took it up. They asked our questions. So it made it into the public record. The Bureau of Indian Affairs responded on the record, and it made it into the final report as well. So I feel like our time in Geneva was really well spent. We had a lot of success. I think things went as well as we could have hoped through our participation in the CERD. And so some of the follow-ups that we've done since our experience at CERD, we just noticed that, okay, there is a voice for us here in the international community, and that when we provide the information, the international community is listening and does not approve of how the U.S. is treating this issue. And most importantly, I think what it gave us was a tool that we can use with the administration at the federal level. They seem to be really responsive to the advocacy at first that we did at the international level. And so now we're going to continue to use some of these international tools to our advantage. And one example is the most recent World Conference on Indigenous Peoples, which was actually a high-level plenary meeting of the General Assembly of the UN, just happened less than a month ago, maybe a couple weeks ago. And we were able to successfully advocate to have a paragraph included in the outcome document, which says we commit to promoting the rights of every Indigenous child in community with members of his or her group to enjoy his or her own culture, profess and practice his or her own religion, or use his or her own language. we're also we've also written a shadow report for the periodic review. And then once we got back to the U.S., we followed up with the Bureau of Indian Affairs and are in communication with them regarding the public declarations that they made during the CERD when the U.S. responded to the CERD committee's questions that we had provided to them. And so it helps us, one, it builds an international record of recommendations that we can use, and the language that comes out of these committee meetings and these final reports and outcome documents, we're going to include that in our testimony and going forward and in our presentation. So it was really helpful for us, and we're going to continue doing this work.
Thank you, Jocelyn, for that report as well. Again, it was very informative, both your and Stephanie's reports on how you all have been able to use the CERD review as an international mechanism, as well as the universal periodic review that you just mentioned.
So, and I'll just mention quickly, sorry, I just want to say thanks to the Human Rights Network for assisting us in being able to attend. We wouldn't have been able to if it weren't for your contributions. And I also was able, I had to piece together four different funding sources from three different countries to be able to attend. So I really, really appreciate the support that the Human Rights Network provided to us.
Well, thank you for that. So instead of taking questions now, I'm going to ask Ricky Levy with the Woodhull Sexual Freedom Alliance to give her report back on their recent Sexual Freedom Summit. And Ricky, you should be unmuted. Are you here on the phone? *6 would unmute you. Ricky? Okay, so I'm thinking she may not be on the phone yet. So I'm going to move along to Malifi with the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement. Malifi Ascara was one of the key organizers for the recent Chronic meeting, and I'll let him explain what Chronic is. Malifi, you can *6 to unmute and provide us with a report out from you guys' recent meeting in Greenville.
Okay, thanks. I am Malifi Ascara, and we did Chronic. Chronic stands for Carolina's Human Rights Organizing Conference, 2014. The conference went pretty good. We had about 55 people there, and we did a couple of plenaries, one dealing with intersection of human rights with other movements and campaigns, and another one on organizing human rights in the South, along with six forums dealing with social, labor, environmental, racial, economic, and militarism. We did a survey at the end of the conference also, and the surveys came back pretty positive. It was very informative, but also people wanted to continue it or do it again. And plus, they also wanted to form some type of working groups from the conference. We haven't had a follow-up meeting since the conference for the people that was involved, but at this point, we're looking at developing a mailing list, like a listserv. We have people that volunteer to work on that. Also, we're going to need to find the purpose and objectives of a conference if we continue to do it in the future. We did have the conference recorded where we are looking to upload those videos to the Internet. We have somebody that said they would do that, and I think it's just a matter of the schedule allowing them to do it. And also, we suggest we have a similar calendar of events. Let's see. Also, the other thing we're looking at is how do we do, if we do future conferences, how do we do it without competing with existing events? So overall, the conference was, I think, very good. It was successful. And like I said, there's a lot of talk about doing future conferences of this type. So that was basically what I had from it.
Okay. Thank you, Malifi. And so I'm going to just say that personally it was exciting to go to my home state for a human rights organizing conference. So we were really happy that you guys brought folks from North Carolina and South Carolina together for the conference. The Ricky, are you
I am.
Okay, good.
I was before too, but
you were testing my technical savvy, which is not.
I was, and you did not pass. But neither did I.
Okay. So we're going to have Ricky Levy with the Woodhull Sexual Freedom Alliance report back on their recent summit.
Thanks, Rachel. Thank you, too, for inviting me to share our experience with our Sexual Freedom Summit. And thank you, too, to the network for their wonderful training and support on an ongoing basis on all of the issues on which we work. I also have to apologize up front because I'll have to leave the meeting at some point prior to the end for another commitment. But for right now, let me tell you about our Sexual Freedom Summit. This is an annual event. 2015 will be our sixth year. We've grown every year in giving this summit, and it is a four-day event. The goals of the summit are the same as those of Woodhull Sexual Freedom Alliance, and that includes being the national voice that consistently raises interconnections between various identities, communities, and the issue of human rights, specifically sexual freedom as a fundamental human right. We work with activists, organizations, coalitions, individuals, both inside and outside of the human rights sexual freedom framework. We challenged ourselves, and the summit is part of that challenge, to focus on the people outside of our traditional circles. What I mean by that is we who are activists, we who are working on these issues, already agree with one another on most of the issues being addressed today in our various communities. So we don't need to convince one another of our human rights. The people we need to convince are outside of the circle. But we so often proceed with conversations inside our house. We wanted the summit to bring these issues to people who would not traditionally be attending a human rights or civil rights conference. We were fortunate enough to be able to work closely with the network in developing both the focus of the summit and an all-day, 8-hour, labor-intensive human rights institute. The summit has supported us each year in this. I'm sorry, the network has supported us each year in putting on this institute. The Human Rights Institute, like the summit, attempts to bring the conversation about human rights and sexual rights, gender justice issues, to the attendees of the summit in a way that's understandable, engaging, educational, and energizing. We want people to be able to leave our training and our summit both with a vision of the future they want to see and hopefully the tools that will allow them to realize those visions. We also do something that's I believe is a little unique. We don't focus just on the negatives and the dire consequences of infringement on human rights. We also talk about the fact that, particularly in the area of sexual freedom, pleasure and desire are often motivators in accessing our human rights, but people don't think about them in terms of human rights. We charge our task, our presenters with the task of tying their presentation to human rights. One of the challenges that we face, and I think it's mirrored in much of the human rights community's attempts to outreach, is that people don't think in terms of human rights. They're used to thinking in terms of civil rights. They don't, as a matter of fact, and we know this only anecdotally by doing casual questions, almost the last thing they think of as having in common with all the other people in the room is that everyone is a human being. So sometimes presenters go ahead with their own workshops and fail to make the connection. We try to help with that, but it tells us there's so much more work to be done in giving people the tools and the conversations and the examples to include human rights in all the work that's being done. One of the things that I think we need is more people who are working on human rights coming to events like the Sexual Freedom Summit. We present the Human Rights Institute at a conference called Creating Change, which is the largest LGBT conference in the world for political change. We've done it 2 years with Yolande. It might be 1 year. And this year, we have been asked to come back and do it again. For many of the young people, and there are a lot of young people at this conference, thinking in terms of human rights is a big stretch for them. And so that is specifically one of our target audiences, the people coming into activism behind us who will carry these goals forward. That's it.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ricky, and thank you, Stephanie, Jocelyn, Malisi, and Ricky. We'll open up for questions to the first four presenters for about 3 to 5 minutes. So if anyone has a question, if you press star one, hit star one, you would come up in the question queue, and we will call on you. Okay, so I'm not seeing any questions come up in the queue. If people have questions, we'll have additional time before we get off the phone for questions, and you please feel free to ask them then as well. So now we're going to move to the next part of the member call agenda, which is the member sharing part. And again, as I mentioned earlier, we really want the calls to serve more of an opportunity for you all to share what you're doing with one another, and really want to hear back from you about the exciting work you're doing and that you want to share with others. and this being an opportunity to do that. So we put out the call again and had several folks respond, which we were really excited about. And I'm going to go through calling on the different folks that will have several minutes to share on their work. And so I'm going to call now on Jihad Abdul-Mumit and Paulette Dutel, and I apologize if I pronounce names incorrectly. They're going to share with us about the work of the Jericho, National Jericho Movement, and particularly the National Shakur Liberation Day activities. So, Jihad and Paulette, I turn it over to you.
Yes, thank you so much, Rachel. This is Jihad, greeting everybody.
This is Paulette.
And Paulette is just going to run a little Paulette is in Washington. I'm in Richmond, Virginia. So he's in two different locations, so that is good. I think I'll just start off by saying again, thank you to the network, Rachel, and everybody that's on the line for the opportunity to be able to share some of the exciting things that we're doing in relationship to the question of human rights. I myself will be going over to the CAT review in Geneva this November and at the White House consultation on the same October the 14th, and so we'll follow that. But some of the things that we've been doing in reference to human rights, you know, this, we are both representatives of the National Jericho Movement to Free All Political Prisoners. And so I shall report the seventh around then, and it's definitely connected with the third report where Attorney Thea Wanzaza had went overseas to Geneva a couple of months ago and represented the same issue because it definitely squarely confronts the issue of racial discrimination as relates to political prisoners from the counterintelligence era and civil rights era 60s and 70s. We have, as far as activities go, just wanted to alert everybody, November the 2nd. November the 2nd is a Sunday, but as of last year, we're making November 2nd a national holiday, and we're calling it National Asada Shakur Liberation Day. Asada Shakur was a member of the Black Panther Party. She was liberated from prison in 1979 on November the 2nd, and now that the government has put her on the first woman, black woman at that, on a terrorist list, another terrorist list for a case that dates back to 1973, we decided to make that a holiday to celebrate her freedom in political asylum, which Cuba has given her, and that's where she resides at a particular time. But also, it gives us the opportunity to usher in all the different various human rights issues on this particular day. We're asking you to consider making that a holiday for yourself. Also, to talk about issues as it relates to political prisoners, mass incarceration, a control unit, racial profiling, all those types of issues that would end up on the discrimination page or the torture page. So different cities are having that on Saturday, Sunday being actually November the 2nd itself, and call this on talk about specifically what's going on in Washington, D.C.
Thank you. I'm in Washington, D.C. I'm actually in the classroom, so I'm just going to give you the information. On Saturday, November the 1st, at the University of D.C. School of Law, we are having our second annual education and celebration of the liberation of Asada, and we will be having presentations by various members of Jericho and other organizations on the Commission on the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was a concept developed by Mutulu Shakur. Jihad will be making a presentation on the CAT and his trip to Geneva. We will be having a juvenile justice panel from the Chicano community, as well as NUBUF, the New Black United Front, and the National Lawyers Guild. And it's open to the public. We're asking for a sliding scale. It's from 9:30 to 5. And we would like to invite anybody that's in the area. Stephanie, if you could get a hold of me at nationaljericho@gmail.com. I'd like to send you the information because we are having a piece on juvenile justice, and maybe you would be available to have something to say about young women in the child welfare
departments that are being put on these drugs, it would fit right in with what we're doing. So you can get a hold of myself at 646-271-4677 or JerichoDC1492 at gmail.com for more information. It is on both of our Facebook pages, National Jericho and the Jericho Movement, and we would really like to build this. It's an important event. And it's important for people to understand that we are able to liberate our people. Okay, thank you. 9:30 to 5, Saturday, November 1st, UDC Law School. There will be lunch. We have child care by the DC Child Care Collective. And we'd really like to see as many people come and participate as possible. Thank you.
Thank you both, Jihad and Paulette.
Thank you, Rachel. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And so now we'll move to Sarah Davila Ruhak. Sarah, let's see. Okay, Sarah may not be here, so I'm going to move on to Afia. Wangaza. And Afia, if you can hit star six. Afia?
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can hear you now.
Okay. Uh-huh. Well, good afternoon, everyone. And I especially want to thank you for being on this call as members, because as a membership organization, without member participation, it winds up being dysfunctional and counterproductive formation. So I want to thank first all of you who've taken time out of your busy day to be present. I'd also like to thank Rachel and the network staff for organizing this and our previous membership calls, and I look forward to our continued developing this process and this opportunity for members to talk to each other and to share the work that we're doing. I'm talking about two membership formations, one of which is the Political Prisoner State Repression Working Group, which came out of the, I think it's the 2009 biennial, wherein I proposed that the network take up the issue of political prisoners, and we formed a working group to deal with the issue of political prisoners and state repression in light of the fact that they are interconnected, and we don't have political prisoners if we don't have state repression. So we began at that process, at that point, to develop a strategy or a campaign, what has become a campaign, to, as we say, put and keep U.S. COINTELPRO civil rights era political activists and human rights defenders on the global human rights agenda and keep them there. Along that line, we began in November of 2010, after having filed a shadow report back in April of 2010, to lobby the members of the international community in support of U.S. political prisoners at the U.S.'s first Universal Periodic Review. And the Universal Periodic Review is different from the other reviews in that, treaty reviews in that, the UPR is a peer review. That is, one country is reviewed by all the other countries as compared with the other three treaties to which the United States is a party, being reviewed by experts on the particular treaties and issues. So we were able at that time, in November of 2010, to have the one of the historic 228 recommendations, as they're called, more criticisms in practicality of the United States' failure to comply with the terms of the Universal Periodic Review and meet its obligations under the core documents as well as the additional three treaties. That the United States was called upon to, one, stop discriminating or end discrimination against people of African descent, and secondly, to release all political prisoners, including Lina Peltier and Lamia Abu-Jamal. It was the first time that the issue and the existence of political prisoners and the conditions of incarceration have been included and threaded throughout the official UN Human Rights Council's records. Contrary to history, the United States did not deny the existence of political prisoners. Indeed, the head of the delegation requested a copy of the list of political prisoners. And that relationship has, quite frankly, grown over the years. I would say months. It feels like months, but over the past 4 years, in addressing the issue of political prisoners, we, meaning the Malcolm X Center for Self-Determination, and in partnership with Jericho and other organizations, have participated in each review, and the attendant White House consultations on the various treaties in anticipation of the reviews, as there's one coming up October 14th, as Jihad mentioned, that will address issues relating to CAT, which will be heard November 12th and 13th, and then the UPR, which will occur in, as I understand at this point, May of 2015. With each review, we've been able to build a record in support of the existence, the conditions of incarceration, and a lead up to a resolution of the status of COINTELPRO civil rights era political activists and human rights defenders, beginning with the UPR, going then to the International Covenant for Civil and Political Rights, where we had a direct reference to civil rights era prisoners, and the expert referring specifically to the Angola 3 and the mistreatment of Herman Wallace, who, like Albert Woodfox, had been held in solitary confinement for over 40 years, Herman being released 4 days before his death on a federal court order, and despite objections of the local prosecutor and the department, Louisiana Department of Corrections. We were able to go from that treaty review to CERD, the Convention for the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, focusing on the fact that COINTELPRO civil rights era human rights defenders and political activists were prosecuted on a race-based illegal program spearheaded by the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and I would urge anyone who's not familiar with Talpro, to Google it. WikiLeaks has a very good treatment of it, as well as being able to refer to the UN's official page website and the network's website to look at the copies of the reports. At CERD, we were delighted to have what was essentially a sentence, a full sentence from our report, which summarized the status of political prisoners in the United States, and have that raised with the U.S. delegation and called upon the U.S. delegation to, at its next regular appearance, to report on the status of COINTELPRO civil rights era political prisoners in the United States. That was an extraordinary moment and landmark in the development of the campaign to, as I said earlier, to put and to keep U.S. political prisoners on the global human rights agenda. We look forward to seeing what happens in 5 years when the United States must report on the status of political prisoners. We will be going to Geneva in November, continuing to raise the issue of political prisoners and linking that more broadly to the issue of repression, political repression, as it has continued to grow in the United States, as the United States has continued to its assault on the rest of the world and the blowback that it is experiencing and that we are experiencing as a result of it, including up to and including, of course, the murder of Michael Brown and the militarization of law enforcement. We expect to be as successful with CAT as we have been with the previous three reviews. The political prisoner community has been energized and revitalized as a result of the success, and we look forward to its continued and broader work on the ground in the United States as is necessary in order to make any treaty review success meaningful. The second working group, and we invite persons interested in work regarding political prisoners and state repression to join the working group so that we are spreading the issue more broadly throughout the network, in fact. There's a great deal of intersectionality between political prisoners, state repression, and the many of the issues that we deal with, that we in the network deal with, whether we're talking about national security, police crimes, or there's a third, mass incarceration, that all of us are dealing with in on some level or another. So please feel free to join us. The second issue, working group, is that of the descendants of Africans enslaved in the U.S. working group. The mission of the working group is to address the political, economic, social, and cultural issues of descendants of Africans enslaved in the U.S. in order to pursue our self-determination and to support all people of African descent throughout the diaspora in their pursuit of the same. That working group grows out of a concern that has existed and continues to exist within the network, and that, although it's not limited to the network, I may add, and that is the marginalization of Black people in the society and in the U.S. Human Rights Network. the object of the working group is to ensure that the that all members, including black people, are treated equally with mutual respect, reciprocity, and equity within within the organization, and we urge participation in that working group as well. That group came into existence at CERD in Geneva because of the marginalized treatment of black people in Geneva came to a head. And in conjunction with the descendants, or Deists as we call it, descendants of Africans enslaved in the U.S., an allies group was formed. So if you are not a descendant of Africans enslaved in the U.S., but interested in addressing substantively the question of solidarity, we would invite you to join the allies group, and you may contact me for either one. I want to thank you for your time, and again, there can be no membership organization without membership input and participation. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Afia, for providing an overview of those two working groups. And I think now we'll move on to Sarah Davila Ruhak, who is on the phone. If you are muted, Sarah, and would hit star six. Are you there?
Yes, I am here. Can you hear me?
Yes, great. And so Sarah is with the International Human Rights Clinic of the John Marshall Law School, and she's going to talk with us some about the Chicago Declaration on the Rights of Older Persons. So with that, Sarah, I turn it over to you.
Sure. Thank you very much. I will actually be very brief. We have been working on the Chicago Declaration on the Rights of Older Persons, and it was drafted by an international group, including academia, NGOs, and legal communities, and actually experts in the field. The declaration was drafted in consultation not only with key scholars on aging, but also representatives of many important NGOs on aging and leaders in the aging policy field. So the declaration, even though it draws from a variety of international human rights instruments such as the ICCPR, the ICESCR, the CERD, it seeks to take the protections of older persons further and to basically extend their protections to be universal. I think that the Chicago Declaration tries to take a step further in taking the special circumstances of older persons' dignity and equality sort of as a central characteristics of the instrument. It also recognizes not only the role of the state in traditional state action, but also the importance of private persons and entities in being taken into account into the context of accountability, which is something I think quite innovative and necessary in human rights. And, of course, we've seen that in a lot of human rights case law and regional mechanisms. What else? So there is explicit protections for the right to self-determination, freedom from exploitation, autonomy, assistance and support, and the recognition of the integral role that they play in our communities and the need for visibility. We're basically working on this draft of the Chicago Declaration. We presented it to the United Nations Open-Ended Working Group on the Aging, and for on the fifth meeting at the UN in August, and we hope that we can continue working with NGOs to add enforcement language so that we can move towards a draft convention on the rights of older persons. I wanted to present today because I want to open sort of the group of experts, whether it's human rights experts or experts in the area of aging, to work with us. We want this to be a collaborative effort to reflect not only different areas of expertise, but legal tradition, so that it is a truly international document. I believe it was one of the emails had an attachment, I believe. Is that true, Rachel?
Yes, and you reminded me, as well as Afia, we'll put the resources and links to persons' email addresses that they can contact and any resources that have been shared on the website so that we can call folks' attention to that when we send out the audio from the call.
Wonderful. So we welcome persons and groups in the call and outside to contact me or Professor Schwinn so that we can sort of get connected and get your input. I welcome to not only, your comments, but to establish a working relationship throughout this process, because we all know that getting a new draft convention is a long process at the UN and ultimately having it pass. So we're here for the long haul, and we are just we're just happy that we get to work on this sort of innovative and important issue. Thank you so much.
And thank you, Sarah. I'm glad you were able to get the link to work. And so now I'll move to Laura Roscoe's with the 100 Cities for CDAO campaign. Laura, if you are muted, if you could press *6.
Hi, Rachel. Hi. And everyone. Thank you so much for inviting me on today's call to talk about the 100 Cities for CDAO campaign. My name is Laura Roscoe's, and I'm with the Center for Women's Health and Human Rights at Suffolk University in Boston. So the 100 Cities for CDAW, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, campaign was launched during the Commission on the Status of Women meetings back in March. It was a joint effort of civil society organizations based in and around San Francisco and the Department on the Status of Women in San Francisco to push out replications and revisions and experiments on the San Francisco ordinance implementing CDAW within the municipal government of San Francisco. And they feel that that implementation effort, now 15 years old, has made a significant difference in reducing the level of violence against women and raising the minimum wage and improving working conditions around issues like paid family leave and flexible working hours and in other things in terms of civic infrastructure. For example, the amount of money invested in pedestrian walkways and curb cuts, things that benefit or equalize a little bit the benefits of an urban environment for women as well as men. And at that kickoff, a lot of people came to the kickoff, but they didn't really have an infrastructure. They had an idea. And people went home from that meeting in New York to different hometowns and started working. And so started working in places like Boulder and Louisville and Pittsburgh. And so what we've been doing since then is really trying to create some sort of infrastructure to support that local work. And that's why I wanted to come on this call, because We're struggling with this question of how to build infrastructure for people to communicate across localities and share their processes and their work with each other so that they can cross-fertilize and energize themselves. And so I thought this would be a good place to talk about this. This is really, it's thrilling to hear about how the work of so many diverse activists in the United States is being brought up to the international level. And what we're talking about here is really maybe sort of a reverse direction of moving human rights forward, especially human rights processes of accountability and change back to the local level. And so I would be really interested in hearing from any of you who think your work intersects at all with this project of eliminating discrimination against women and, of course, all forms of discrimination within our municipalities through our Cities for CEDAW mechanism that we're slowly building. So we have a website at Cities for CEDAW, FOR.org, and we've been building some resources there, and we've been holding monthly video conferences to connect activists, and we've been collecting resources that can help them and creating resources that can help people do this in their communities. And I am frankly really thrilled to see this work coming back up into the foreground, because I was really respectful and involved with work that was done in the late 1990s, pretty much spearheaded by Ione Biggs in Cleveland and Billy Heller in L.A. to have CEDAW endorsing resolutions adopted at the local level. And we are hoping that this is, of course, another way to build through practice and familiarity political will for national ratification at some future date.
Okay, and thank you very much for that, Laura. And so I don't see the Carolyn Ramsey Miriam on the call. Carolyn, I'll give you a minute to speak up if you are on the call. You can unmute your phone with star 6. Okay. So with that, we're at about 1:15 and the call is scheduled to go to 1:30. I wanted to open the call up for questions and comments. Especially if anyone wants to respond to the questions that our question Laura posed there at the end of her presentation in terms of ideas related to the campaign. So we will wait a couple of minutes to see if anyone raises their hand. You can do that by pressing star 1. And while folks are, we do have some questions. Before I start calling on folks, I just want to restate what I said earlier. We definitely have resources that have been shared by some of the presenters, as well as folks have referred to email addresses, either their own or general email addresses, as well as websites, that we will put up on the network website on this quarterly member meeting page. And we will send an email as follow-up to folks to make it real clear where to go for that link. So I just wanted to remind you of that. So George Lipman.
Yes, hi. Good morning.
George.
Hey, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, George Lipman with the Berkeley Peace and Justice Commission, which is a city commission in Berkeley, California. We're very excited to be on the call and particularly gratified that the issues of political prisoners have been raised. I just want to bring a little news to the group that in the city of Berkeley, we have just had a victory in the city council. They have voted to forward the lengthy CAT and ICCPR compliance reports that the Peace and Justice Commission authored to the respective committees. As far as we know, this is the first time in the U.S. that a city has embarked on a process of honestly reporting on its human rights compliance. We would love to be in touch with other communities that would like to do something similar. I know this is a little different from what most folks are doing from civil society. We are a group of community activists who have come into the city government on an advisory level. So we're creating something new, and we're really thrilled that this is another tool that's opening up for people to use. Our reports are pretty comprehensive. They're covering, in terms of CAT, solitary confinement and maximum security, jail conditions, sexual violence in the community against women and LGBT people, incarceration of youth, militarization of policing, and intelligence gathering on the community. ICCPR report covers a whole variety of particularly racial discrimination and disparities in fields such as health, housing, education, law enforcement, and employment. My address, I'll just throw out, if anyone wants to be in touch, is george@igc.org. And I can be also contacted through Rebecca Landy of the network, and hope to hear from people.
Okay, thank you for that, George, and that's excellent news. Hats off to you all, and congratulations again for the work. So if you would mute yourself by pressing *6, and Dawita Desir, I'm going to unmute you. We can
hello?
Hear you now. We can hear you
okay.
Now.
Okay. Do I need to reintroduce myself?
Please.
Okay. This is Dawita Desir of the DDPA Watch Group, the Durban Declaration and Program of Action Watch Group. I'm in New York. I wanted to say thank you for organizing this conference call. I'm calling in part to let Stephanie know that I'm here. I believe there's an announcement that she'll be making about work that we're trying to do together. But I also do have a question for Stephanie, which is what were some of the specific responses given to you, shared with you by the international community with regard to the reports, the findings that you presented to them about the use of psychotropic drugs among African-American women and girls, and whether or not anyone revealed similar events, similar situations taking place in their states.
Dorothy, hi. Peace, sister.
Hi.
Yeah, so specifically, it was an issue, as I raised earlier, that no one knew a lot about.
Yeah.
You know, we hear a lot about forced psychiatry, particularly as it relates to those in mental health facilities, but rarely do we hear about the specific impact that is occurring with foster youth. And I would even go on to say juvenile justice youth as well. So when I raised the issue, I had to do a lot of advocacy behind the scenes to get the issue raised because, as I'm sure you are aware, you've been to Geneva many times. We have limited time to raise
mm-hmm.
particular issues. So a lot of my advocacy on the specific issue that I came there to raise really was behind the scenes. And so there was a genuine interest by, I would say, particularly the African committee members on that particular issue as it related to girls. So I think that having the opportunity to meet with them behind the scenes and really pushing that advocacy and raising an issue that's never been raised on the global stage before really piqued their interest, and they were very concerned about what was happening. As it related to others who had spoken with me, there were several other delegation members who were very interested in the issue and were connecting it to issues as it related to the adult populations, like, you know, black women in the criminal justice system, which was of particular interest. There are some advocates out in the in California, in the L.A. area, who had noted that, you know, you have them on the younger end, and you fast forward 20 years, and those same women that we deal with in prisons are taking psychotropic meds and have spoken to, the impact that those psychotropic meds have had on them. There have also been some Latina women who have shared with me going through the child welfare system and moving into the criminal justice system, the impact that psychotropic drugs have had on them. So the issue as it relates to foster youth is not singularly to foster youth, but I think it spans a number of populations. But the interesting part about all of that is that a number of the people who don't work specifically with foster youth have been in foster care before. And so there is, an extreme psychotropic and psychiatric drugging of black children, period. I think that needs to be said. Black children are being drugged with psychotropic drugs at very, very high rates. And again, as it relates to girls, because there's so little focus on black girls in any venue, the UN has even stated that they really want information as it pertains to girls and women, because oftentimes that discrimination is actually different, or it goes unnoticed. So I hope I answered your question with respect to that.
Yeah.
And, Stephanie, thank you for responding, and Dawita, thank you for the question. Stephanie, do you want to take a few minutes to share about, you had mentioned you wanted to share about some other work during
the and I'm actually, thank you, Rachel, very much for the space to be able to do this, and Devotee, thank you for the question. Specifically, I wanted to raise that on December 23rd of 2013, the UN had announced that the International Decade of People of African Descent will begin on January 1st, 2015, and will end on December 31st, 2025. And Dorothy Desir, who just spoke, and I will be co-chairing decade work through the network, and we will also be submitting an application with the support of the Malcolm X Grassroots Center for Self-Determination in South Carolina to a MIAT on the decade. Dorothy and I will be co-chairing that, and Salima Hankins, who was the CERB coordinator with the network, will be working with us on this initiative. We will be submitting the MIAT in short order, and we are planning a launch event in New York City in January, and we are hoping that it will be able to be done at the United Nations. We will also be sending out a blast on January 1st, ceremonializing the decade. And if you're interested in working with us on the decade, you can contact me, Stephanie Franklin, at FRANKLIN at franklinlaw.us, or Dorothy Desir at D like David, O, W like Wendy, O, D like David again, E, S like Sam, I, R like Ralph, at iCloud.com. And I can also send our email addresses to Rachel and hopes, and then Rachel, you can guide me on this. I could send out to the listserv our email addresses and the decade work that we will be launching on January the 1st. So, Devotee, I don't know if you have anything additional you'd like to add to that.
Yes. I just wanted to add that we're thinking about hosting a number of events over the course of the decade, focused on three principal areas. One is health. The other is African descendants, traditional African descendants spiritual systems, or what I refer to as the Afro-Pacific spiritual systems, and then education, because there are a number of places in which the repression of human rights, especially as it concerns African descendants, has a intersectional element. And the tribunal that will take place will help establish these areas of intersectionality, but it will also speak to a term that I coined called state recidivism, which in fact relates to the issue raised by one of the previous speakers, where the state itself or the agents of the state uses its resources to suppress the human rights of African descendants and indigenous people. So it's the issue of the violation of the sovereignty of the African person, specifically in the areas of spirituality, health, education, among other things that we'll be addressing. So we're very excited about that and look forward to certainly working with Stephanie and Kalima and any of you who want to be a part of this. But this is also a long-haul effort. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for that. And, yes, Stephanie, we can follow up to make sure we send out the information. I did want to just let everybody know, when Stephanie referred to a MIAT, it's called a Member-Initiated Action Team. It's one of the network member structures, and we are really excited that more members are looking to utilize that member structure to collaborate and to work together, just as Stephanie and Dawita have just described, on various issue areas or across issue areas. And related to that, Laura, I'll follow up with you. Another member, Kyle Fees, is interested in working on a MIAT related to local government and state government implementation. And I'm not sure if you were able to participate in the recent educational webinar that we had on local implementation, but we can make sure that you get the link to that and share with your network if you weren't able to attend. We have another question. Standish Willis. Standish, I'm unmuting you.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yeah, thank you very much for this moment. I'll be very brief because I know our time is short. This membership call has been very, very informative. Of course, I'm familiar with the political prisoners, Brother Jihad. Glad you're on the call, and Sister Field, and Stephanie. But let me just comment. In Chicago, and I'll be very brief, we had an ongoing battle around police torture of black men and boys for 2.5 decades. And it was only after I encouraged my colleagues to go international in 2005, 2006, that the CAC Commission mentioned Chicago torture, and the leader of that conspiracy was indicted within a matter of months after the concluding observations. So now we are responding to the United States report because CAT is coming up again in a few weeks. And the observation that I'll make for you is that the United States has tried to be as minimal in their correction of the problem as possible, although they did indict the leader of the conspiracy, John Burge. He got out of prison yesterday after 4 years after torturing over 100 black men and boys. Many of them got life sentences for crimes they didn't commit. Several were on death row. he gets 4 years. So I prepare a report that was submitted critiquing the United States' response to the CAT's direction that they did not indict other detectives. There were over 50 involved. They indicted John Burge, the leader, and they charged him with a very minimum offense, that is, lying on interrogatories in a federal civil rights case. And so he had 4 years. So be aware, we will have victories, but the United States will, if they respond at all, would try to minimize their response and do the least possible to correct the problem. So this time my report has to do with critiquing the United States, but also raising the issue of reparations and the release of over 40 that remain in prison. One of them, my client, has been in segregation, if you can imagine this, for over 20 years. And, of course, the special rapporteur on CAT just talked about segregation in the Angola case. So, again, thanks a lot for this very informative discussion. The scope of it helps me when I'm talking to our people in the communities, because the first question they ask is, how does this human rights stuff work? How is it different from civil rights? Well, having your best practices helped me to explain that, and I'm deeply grateful.
Thank you for that, Standish. And so we're at an hour and 31 minutes. I do want to give my colleague Yolande a moment to go over some of our upcoming education webinars and activities. Before I do that, I want to let everyone know that we have a new staff on board, Tinjiwe McHarris. She's unable to join the call today. She is the director of our Human Rights at Home campaign, so we just want to make sure everyone knew about that. We want to welcome Yolande back from maternity leave. It's great to have her back and have a full team on board. And I also just want to reiterate something that Standish said and a couple of others. This has been a great member meeting. We have we've just heard a real breadth of the work that folks are engaged in, and that is just awesome. It's really good for us to hear it, and we don't want to talk a lot on these calls. We want to hear from you all, and we want you all to share. And so we are reflecting on ways to make that interaction more real moving forward. So we feel like this was a real good step in the right direction in that regard. I also want to say that we have also hired another employee, Veronica Del Sol, our office manager, human resource administrator. She's joined today. And so you all will be also getting to know Veronica in the months moving forward. With that, Yolande, if you can quickly give us an update on upcoming education events, and welcome back.
Thanks, Rachel, and hi, everyone. So as briefly as possible, I'll go through the upcoming opportunities that we have. And as many of you know, much of the work that we've done this year has focused on the international mechanisms, which are the treaty review and the UPR process. So I'll start there, which is to say that at the end of this month, we'll host a webinar with the USHRN Convention Against Torture Task Force to prepare participants to effectively engage in advocacy before the committee that oversees and that will be reviewing the U.S. in Geneva. The webinar will also be providing a brief introduction to the UN in Geneva, and as well as what participants can expect to, how they can expect to spend their time while they're there. So look out for registration information in the coming week. Related to CAT, we have the task force will be hosting a day of action on October 21st, which is the 20th anniversary of the U.S. ratification, or the U.S. formally accepting the treaty as law, and we'll be using the hashtag #EndTorture to connect with folks during that day of action. Related to the UPR, reports were turned in back in September, but we're planning a series of webinars, at least one of which will happen this year, and then moving on into 2015 as we gear up for the in-person dialogue in Geneva in May 2015. So in the interim, we invite you to visit the website to check out the fact sheets and other related resources that we have there to help you engage, prepare to engage in that process. Also in early November, we'll be hosting an introductory webinar on intersectionality, which I hear a lot of you have already been making those connections, and it's an integral part of the way that you do your work. That initial webinar will be an introduction to the concept and the methodology, as well as presenting examples about how folks put that into practice. So just briefly on intersectionality, it's a tool that emerges out of the lived realities and experiences of women of color, specifically the realization that as women, as Black, Latina, Indigenous women, for example, they have experiences of discrimination and oppression that is unique and different than how men of their own racial or ethnic groups experience it. The other critical aspect of thinking about oppression and human rights violations within an intersectional framework is that it allows activists to understand that it's not just our identities that are overlapping and intersect, if you will, but that the systems of discrimination, so racism, classism, sexism, homophobia, also overlap and function together. And so the strategies and the solutions to eliminating and effectively combating them must also take that into account, and they must also overlap and intersect. So ultimately, intersectionality is about how we advocates, activists, engage in effective movement building, organizing, policy advocacy strategies, and sound analyses of oppression that center the experiences of those who are most directly impacted and those on the margins and extreme margins in order to shift power and create sustainable, lasting change. As one member puts it on a recent call, intersectionality is a powerful tool for engaging in radical, systemic-level liberation. So with this and other questions in mind, we have convened a small working group of about 7 members to create a set of resources and tools to help support practical applications of intersectionality by members, partners, and allies. Key components of the project on intersectionality will be conversations and related resources on the concepts and practices of self-determination and solidarity, which we see as intimately related to the practice of intersectionality. What do these mean to different groups are part of the questions will be answered, as well as how do we respect and practice these effectively, and how do we institutionalize these as part of our ongoing work and effort. Just a couple more announcements related to upcoming educational opportunities. One is our annual human rights status report, which is, in essence, a broad assessment of the state of human rights in the U.S. That's going to be presented and written in a really accessible and plain language format for folks to get a sense of what's been happening over the course of since the last report. This will be released on December 10th, which, as we all know, is International Human Rights Day. And then we have a couple more that I'll turn over to my colleague, Mike Ward, who's our newest communications manager, and he'll talk briefly about our UDHR campaign. And then after Mike, Rachel will talk about our regional meeting and human rights hearing in New Orleans. So, Mike.
Hi, Yolanda. Can you guys hear me?
Yes. Yes.
Excellent. So the UDHR campaign is coincides with December 10th, which is Human Rights Day, and also the celebration of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. We're running a campaign that goes from November 10th to December 10th, 30 days to represent the 30 articles of the Universal Declaration. And the purpose of the campaign is to promote the work of USHRN members. The cornerstone will be a video series that applications closed for the video series this past week, but we are still accepting organizations to be highlighted on our website via a text copy rather than video. So if you or your organization is interested in being highlighted as a part of our UDHR campaign, you can email me at communications@USHRnetwork.org. Thanks.
Okay. And thank you for that, Yolanda and Mike. And I will speak briefly about the regional meeting that we'll be holding in New Orleans on October 25th, and then ask Rebecca to speak briefly about the human rights hearing that'll be the day prior in New Orleans before we close. So we will be convening our second regional meeting. We held our first in 2012 in Oklahoma, and this will be our second for 2014. We'll hold it in New Orleans. We'll be bringing folks together for the day, and it's really a regional meeting. So we want during that day to do a lot of what we've done here today on the call, having members, partners, allies share what they're doing, learn from one another, talk about some of the concepts and issues that Yolanda mentioned in the context of intersectionality, solidarity, self-determination, how those impact, enhance our work. And it'll be an all-day event. If anyone on the call is interested and can attend, you can send me an email. I can make sure you have the link. But there is a link from the home page to the page about the meeting and the registration. But again, we're trying to hold a regional meeting in different parts of the country on the off year of our biannual conference. So with that, Rebecca, if you can unmute yourself and just speak real briefly about the hearing, and then we'll bring the call to a close.
Sure. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Hi, everyone. This is Rebecca Landy. I'm the Human Rights Outreach Coordinator at the network, and we have been organizing a number of human rights hearings. This will be the fourth since this July. We had two in New Mexico and another one in Arizona, and then, as Rachel mentioned, we'll have another one in New Orleans on Friday, October the 24th, right before our regional meeting. And these are really great opportunities for people to come together and share what's happening in their community. We convene a panel of experts or jurists, national human rights advocates and local advocates to preside over these human rights hearings. And we also, for this hearing, have invited activists that took part in our New Mexico and Arizona hearings as well. And we will be holding future hearings, one in collaboration with the Center for Reproductive Rights on International Women's Day on March 8th in the Rio Grande Valley, and we have another one planned in Detroit for later in the year before the Universal Periodic Review. So we're documenting these hearings via video, and we're putting together short videos, and we're also putting together a report that we'll be distributing. So if you're interested in taking part in our hearing in New Orleans, you can go to our website. There's information on registering, and there's also a testimony guide so that you can testify. But we'd love to have as many people come out in New Orleans as possible. So thank you all, and thanks, everyone, for joining this really great member meeting call.
Yes. And Joel?
Oh, this is Ifia. I'm sorry, my phone cut off, and I wasn't sure that I was back in. I wanted to call everyone's attention to the month of resistance to mass incarceration, police terror, repression, and criminalization of a generation, and to seek out the information that is listed on the network's website regarding the month of resistance.
Okay. And you're just calling attention to that for us, Sophia, before we close?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you, guys. We went 15 minutes over, so our apologies for that. But thank you for those of you that stayed with us through the entire call. Thank you to everyone who has shared. And we appreciate this very much. It was a very rich member meeting, and we are thankful to you all for what you do. And we look forward to continuing work with everybody as we move forward stay on the lookout for the next quarterly call, and thank you, and also an email and follow-up to this one with some of the resources, links, et cetera, we've referenced. Thanks so much to everyone. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bye, everyone. Thanks.
Thank you.